The trick is convincing yourself that the market's fee is worth it. That's the only way to properly deal with volatility and uncertainty. Not just putting up with it, but realizing that it's an admission fee worth paying. There's no guarantee that it will be. Sometimes it rains at Disneyland. But if you view the admission fee as a fine, you'll never enjoy the magic. Find the price, then pay it. Chapter 16. You and Me. The implosion of the dot-com bubble in the early 2000s reduced household wealth by $6.2 trillion. The end of the housing bubble cut away more than $8 trillion. It's hard to overstate how socially devastating financial bubbles can be. They ruin lives. Why do these things happen? And why do they keep happening? Why can't we learn our lessons? The common answer here is that people are greedy, and greed is an indelible feature of human nature. That may be true, and it's a good enough answer for most, but remember from chapter 1, no one is crazy. People make financial decisions they regret, and they often do so with scarce information and without logic. But the decisions made sense to them when they were made. Blaming bubbles on greed and stopping there misses important lessons about how and why people rationalize what in hindsight look like greedy decisions. Part of why bubbles are hard to learn from is that they are not like cancer, where a biopsy gives us a clear warning and diagnosis. They are closer to the rise and fall of a political party, where the outcome is known in hindsight, but the cause and blame are never agreed upon. Competition for investment returns is fierce, and someone has to own every asset at every point in time. That means the mere idea of bubbles will always be controversial, because no one wants to think they own an overvalued asset. In hindsight, we're more likely to point cynical fingers than to learn lessons. I don't think we'll ever be able to fully explain why bubbles occur. It's like asking why wars occur. There are almost always several reasons, many of them conflicting, all of them controversial. It's too complicated a subject for simple answers. But let me propose one reason they happen that goes both overlooked and applies to you personally. Investors often innocently take cues from other investors who are playing a different game than they are. An idea exists in finance that seems innocent but has done incalculable damage. It's the notion that assets have one rational price in a world where investors have different goals and time horizons. Ask yourself, how much should you pay for Google stock today? The answer depends on who you are. Do you have a 30-year time horizon? Then the smart price to pay involves a sober analysis of Google's discounted cash flows over the next 30 years. Are you looking to cash out within 10 years? Then the price to pay can be figured out by an analysis of the tech industry's potential over the next decade and whether Google management can execute on its vision. Are you looking to sell within a year? Then pay attention to Google's current product sales cycles and whether we'll have a bear market. Are you a day trader? Then the smart price to pay is, who cares? Because you're just trying to squeeze a few bucks out of whatever happens between now and lunchtime, which can be accomplished at any price. When investors have different goals and time horizons, and they do in every asset class, prices that look ridiculous to one person can make sense to another, because the factors those investors pay attention to are different. Take the dot-com bubble in the 1990s. People can look at Yahoo stock in 1999 and say, that was crazy, a zillion times revenue, the valuation made no sense. But many investors who owned Yahoo stock in 1999 had time horizons so short that it made sense for them to pay a ridiculous price. A day trader could accomplish what they need whether Yahoo was at $5 a share or $500 a share, as long as it moved in the right direction that day. And it did for years. An iron rule of finance is that money chases returns to the greatest extent that it can. If an asset has momentum, it's been moving consistently up for a period of time, it's not crazy for a group of short-term traders to assume it will keep moving up. Not indefinitely, just for the short period of time they need it to. Momentum attracts short-term traders in a reasonable way. Then it's off to the races. Bubbles form when the momentum of short-term returns attracts enough money that the makeup of investors shifts from mostly long-term to mostly short-term. That process feeds on itself. As traders push up short-term returns, they attract even more traders. Before long, and it often doesn't take long, the dominant market price setters with the most authority are those with shorter time horizons. Bubbles aren't so much about valuations rising. That's just a symptom of something else. Time horizons shrinking as more short-term traders enter the playing field. It's common to say the dot-com bubble was a time of irrational optimism about the future. But one of the most common headlines of that era was announcing record trading volume, which is what happens when investors are buying and selling in a single day. Investors, particularly the ones setting prices, were not thinking about the next 20 years. The average mutual fund had 120% annual turnover in 1999, meaning they were, at most, thinking about the next 8 months. So were the individual investors who bought those mutual funds. Maggie Mahar wrote in her book, Bull, by the mid-90s, the press had replaced annual scorecards with reports that appeared every 3 months. The change spurred investors to chase performance, rushing to buy the funds at the top of the charts, just when they were the most expensive. This was the era of day trading, short-term option contracts, and up-to-the-minute market commentary. It's not the kind of thing you'd associate with long-term views. The same thing happened during the housing bubble of the mid-2000s. It's hard to justify paying $700,000 for a two-bedroom Florida tract home to raise your family in for the next 10 years. But it makes perfect sense if you plan on flipping the home in a few months into a market with rising prices to make a quick profit, which is exactly what many people were doing during the bubble. Data from Atom, a company that tracks real estate transactions, shows the number of houses in America that sold more than once in a 12-month period, they were flipped, rose fivefold during the bubble, from 20,000 in the first quarter of 2000 to over 100,000 in the first quarter of 2004. Flipping plunged after the bubble to less than 40,000 per quarter, where it's roughly remained since. Do you think these flippers cared about long-term price-to-rent ratios, or whether the prices they paid were backed up by long-term income growth? Of course not. Those numbers weren't relevant to their game. The only thing that mattered to flippers was that the price of the home would be more next month than it was this month. And for many years, it was. You can say a lot about these investors. You can call them speculators. You can call them irresponsible. You can shake your head at their willingness to take huge risks. But I don't think you can call all of them irrational. The formation of bubbles isn't so much about people irrationally participating in long-term investing. They're about people somewhat rationally moving toward short-term trading to capture momentum that had been feeding on itself. What do you expect people to do when momentum creates a big short-term return potential? Sit and watch patiently? Never. That's not how the world works. Profits will always be chased. And short-term traders operate in an area where the rules governing long-term investing, particularly around valuation, are ignored because they're irrelevant to the game being played. That's where things get interesting and where the problems begin. Bubbles do their damage when long-term investors playing one game start taking their cues from those short-term traders playing another. Cisco Systems stock rose 300% in 1999 to $60 a share. At that price, the company was valued at $600 billion, which is insane. Few actually thought it was worth that much. The day traders were just having their fun. Economist Burton Malkiel once pointed out that Cisco's implied growth rate at that valuation meant it would become larger than the entire U.S. economy within 20 years. But if you were a long-term investor in 1999, $60 was the only price available to buy. And many people were buying it at that price. So you may have looked around and said to yourself, wow, maybe these other investors know something I don't. Maybe you went along with it. You even felt smart about it. What you don't realize is that the traders who were setting the marginal price of the stock were playing a different game than you were. $60 a share was a reasonable price for the traders because they planned on selling the stock before the end of the day, when the price would probably be higher. But $60 was a disaster in the making for you because you planned on holding shares for the long run. These two investors rarely even know that each other exist, but they're on the same field running toward each other. When their paths blindly collide, someone gets hurt. Many finance and investment decisions are rooted in watching what other people do and either copying them or betting against them. But when you don't know why someone behaves like they do, you won't know how long they'll continue acting that way, what will make them change their mind, or whether they'll ever learn their lesson. When a commentator on CNBC says, "You should buy this stock," keep in mind that they do not know who you are. Are you a teenager trading for fun? An elderly widow on a limited budget? A hedge fund manager trying to shore up your books before the quarter ends? Are we supposed to think those three people have the same priorities and that whatever level a particular stock is trading at is right for all three of them? It's crazy. It's hard to grasp that other investors have different goals than we do, because an anchor of psychology is not realizing that rational people can see the world through a different lens than your own. Rising prices persuade all investors in ways the best marketers envy. They are a drug that can turn value-conscious investors into dewy-eyed optimists, detached from their own reality by the actions of someone playing a different game than they are. Being swayed by people playing a different game can also throw off how you think you're supposed to spend your money. So much consumer spending, particularly in developed countries, is socially driven, subtly influenced by people you admire, and done because you subtly want people to admire you. And while we can see how much money other people spend on cars, homes, clothes, and vacations, we don't get to see their goals, worries, and aspirations. A young lawyer aiming to be a partner at a prestigious law firm might need to maintain an appearance that I, a writer who can work in sweatpants, have no need for. But when his purchases set my own expectations, I'm wandering down a path of potential disappointment because I'm spending the money without the career boost he's getting. We might not even have different styles. We're just playing a different game. It took me years to figure this out. A takeaway here is that few things matter more with money than understanding your own time horizon and not being persuaded by the actions and behaviors of people playing different games than you are. The main thing I can recommend is going out of your way to identify what game you're playing. It's surprising how few of us do. We call everyone investing money investors, like they're basketball players, all playing the same game with the same rules. When you realize how wrong that notion is, you see how vital it is to simply identify what game you're playing. How I invest my own money is detailed in Chapter 20. But years ago, I wrote out, "I'm a passive investor, optimistic in the world's ability to generate real economic growth, and I'm confident that over the next 30 years, that growth will accrue to my investments." This might seem quaint, but once you write that mission statement down, you realize everything that's unrelated to it, what the market did this year, or whether we'll have a recession next year, is part of a game I'm not playing. So I don't pay attention to it, and am in no danger of being persuaded by it. Next, let's talk about pessimism. Chapter 17, The Seduction of Pessimism. Optimism is the best bet for most people because the world tends to get better for most people most of the time. But pessimism holds a special place in our hearts. Pessimism isn't just more common than optimism. It also sounds smarter. It's intellectually captivating, and it's paid more attention than optimism, which is often viewed as being oblivious to risk. Before we go further, we should define what optimism is. Real optimists don't believe that everything will be great. That's complacency. Optimism is a belief that the odds of a good outcome are in your favor over time, even when there will be setbacks along the way. The simple idea that most people wake up in the morning trying to make things a little better and more productive than wake up looking to cause trouble is the foundation of optimism. It's not complicated. It's not guaranteed either. It's just the most reasonable bet for most people most of the time. The late statistician Hans Rosling put it differently. I am not an optimist. I am a very serious possibilist. Now we can discuss optimism's more compelling sibling, pessimism. December 29th, 2008. The worst year for the economy in modern history is about to close. Stock markets around the world had collapsed. The global financial system was on day-to-day life support. Unemployment was surging. As things looked like they couldn't get worse, the Wall Street Journal published a story arguing that we hadn't seen anything yet. It ran a front-page article on the outlook of a Russian professor named Igor Panarin, whose economic views rival the flair of science fiction writers. The journal wrote, "Around the end of June 2010, or early July, Panarin says the U.S. will break into six pieces, with Alaska reverting to Russian control. California will form the nucleus of what he calls the Californian Republic and will be part of China or under Chinese influence. Texas will be the heart of the Texas Republic, a cluster of states that will go to Mexico or fall under Mexican influence. Washington, D.C. and New York will be part of an Atlantic America that may join the European Union. Canada will grab a group of northern states Professor Panarin calls the Central North American Republic. Hawaii, he suggests, will be a protectorate of Japan or China, and Alaska will be subsumed into Russia." This was not the ramblings of a backroom blog or tinfoil hat newsletter. This was on the front page of the most prestigious financial newspaper in the world. It is fine to be pessimistic about the economy. It's even okay to be apocalyptic. History is full of examples of countries experiencing not just recessions, but disintegrations. The interesting thing about Panarin-type stories is that their polar opposite, forecasts of outrageous optimism, are rarely taken as serious as prophets of doom. Take Japan in the late 1940s. The nation was gutted by defeat from World War II in every way, economically, industrially, culturally, socially. A brutal winter in 1946 caused a famine that limited food to less than 800 calories per person per day. Imagine if a Japanese academic had written a newspaper article during this time that said, "Chin up, everyone. Within our lifetime, our economy will grow to almost 15 times the size it was before the end of the war. Our life expectancy will nearly double. Our stock market will produce returns like any country in history has rarely seen. We will go more than 40 years without ever seeing unemployment top 6%. We will become a world leader in electronic innovation and corporate managerial systems. Before long, we will be so rich that we will own some of the most prized real estate in the United States. Americans, by the way, will be our closest ally, and will try to copy our economic insights." They would have been summarily laughed out of the room and asked to seek a medical evaluation. Keep in mind, the description you just heard is what actually happened in Japan in the generation after the war. But the mirror opposite of Panarin looks absurd in a way a forecast of doom doesn't. Pessimism just sounds smarter and more plausible than optimism. Tell someone that everything will be great, and they're likely to either shrug you off or offer a skeptical eye. Tell someone they're in danger, and you have their undivided attention. If a smart person tells me they have a stock pick that's going to rise tenfold in the next year, I will immediately write them off as full of nonsense. If someone who's full of nonsense tells me that a stock I own is about to collapse because it's an accounting fraud, I will clear my calendar and listen to their every word. Say we'll have a big recession and newspapers will call you. Say we're headed for average growth and no one particularly cares. Say we're nearing the next Great Depression and you'll get on TV. But mention that good times are ahead, or markets have room to run, or that a company has huge potential, and a common reaction from commentators and spectators alike is that you are either a salesman or comically aloof of risks. The investing newsletter industry has known this for years and is now populated by prophets of doom, despite operating in an environment where the stock market has gone up 17,000-fold in the last century, including dividends. This is true beyond finance. Matt Ridley wrote in his book, The Rational Optimist, "A constant drumbeat of pessimism usually drowns out any triumphalist song. If you say the world has been getting better, you may get away with being called naive and insensitive. If you say the world is going to go on getting better, you are considered embarrassingly mad. If, on the other hand, you say catastrophe is imminent, you may expect a MacArthur Genius Award or even the Nobel Peace Prize. In my own adult lifetime, the fashionable reasons for pessimism changed, but the pessimism was constant. Every group of people I ask thinks the world is more frightening, more violent, and more hopeless, in short, more dramatic, than it really is," Hans Rosling wrote in his book, Factfulness. When you realize how much progress, when you realize how much progress humans can make during a lifetime, in everything from economic growth to medical breakthroughs to stock market gains to social equality, you would think optimism would gain more attention than pessimism. And yet, the intellectual allure of pessimism has been known for ages. John Stuart Mill wrote in the 1840s, "I have observed that not the man who hopes when others despair, but the man who despairs when others hope, is admired by a large class of persons as a sage. The question is, why? And how does it impact how we think about money?" Let's repeat the premise that no one is crazy. There are valid reasons why pessimism is seductive when dealing with money. It just helps to know what they are to ensure we don't take them too far. Part of it is instinctual and unavoidable. Kahneman says the asymmetric aversion to loss is an evolutionary shield. He writes, "When directly compared or weighted against each other, losses loom larger than gains. This asymmetry between the power of positive and negative expectations or experiences has an evolutionary history. Organisms that treat threats as more urgent than opportunities have a better chance to survive and reproduce." But a few other things make financial pessimism easy, common, and more persuasive than optimism. One is that money is ubiquitous, so something bad happening tends to affect everyone and captures everyone's attention. This isn't true of, say, weather. A hurricane barreling down on Florida poses no direct risk to 92% of Americans, but a recession barreling down on the economy could impact every single person, including you, so pay attention. This goes for something as specific as the stock market. More than half of all American households directly own stocks. Even among those that don't, the stock market's gyrations are promoted so heavily in the media that the Dow Jones Industrial Average might be the stockless household's most watched economic barometer. Stocks rising 1% might be briefly mentioned in the evening news, but a 1% fall will be reported in bold, all-caps letters, usually written in blood red. The asymmetry is hard to avoid. And while few question or try to explain why the market went up, isn't it supposed to go up? There is almost always an attempt to explain why it went down. Are investors worried about economic growth? Did the Fed screw things up again? Are politicians making bad decisions? Is there another shoe to drop? Narratives about why a decline occurred make them easier to talk about, worry about, and frame a story around what you think will happen next. Usually more of the same. Even if you don't own stocks, those kind of things will grab your attention. Only 2.5% of Americans owned stocks on the eve of the Great Crash of 1929 that sparked the Great Depression. But the majority of Americans, if not the world, watched in amazement as the market collapsed, wondering what it signaled about their own fate. This was true whether you were a lawyer or a farmer or a car mechanic. Historian Eric Rauchway writes, "This fall in value immediately afflicted only a few Americans. But so closely had the others watched the market and regarded it as an index of their fates that they suddenly stopped much of their economic activity. As the economist Joseph Schumpeter later wrote, people felt that the ground under their feet was giving way. There are two topics that will affect your life, whether you are interested in them or not: money and health. While health issues tend to be individual, money issues are more systemic. In a connected system where one person's decisions can affect everyone else, it's understandable why financial risks gain a spotlight and capture attention in a way few other topics can. Another is that pessimists often extrapolate present trends without accounting for how markets adapt. In 2008, environmentalist Lester Brown wrote, "By 2030, China would need 98 million barrels of oil a day. The world is currently producing 85 million barrels a day and may never produce much more than that. There go the world's oil reserves." He's right. The world would run out of oil in that scenario. But that's not how markets work. There is an iron law in economics. Extremely good and extremely bad circumstances rarely stay that way for long because supply and demand adapt in hard-to-predict ways. Consider what happened to oil immediately after Brown's prediction. Oil prices surged in 2008 as growing global demand, much of it from China, crept up to potential output. A barrel of oil sold for $20 in 2001 and $138 by 2008. The new price meant drilling oil was like pulling gold out of the ground. The incentives for oil producers changed dramatically. Hard-to-tap oil supplies that weren't worth the fight at $20 a barrel, the cost of drilling didn't offset the price you could sell it for, became the bonanza of a lifetime now that you could sell a barrel for $138. That sparked a surge of new fracking and horizontal drilling technologies. The Earth has had roughly the same amount of oil reserves for all of human history, and we've known where the big oil deposits are for some time. What changes is the technology we have that lets us economically pull the stuff out of the ground. Oil historian Daniel Yergin writes, 86% of oil reserves in the United States are the result not of what is estimated at time of discovery, but of the revisions that come when our technology improves. That's what happened as fracking took off in 2008. In the United States alone, oil production went from roughly 5 million barrels per day in 2008 to 13 million by 2019. World oil production is now over 100 million barrels per day, some 20% above what Brown assumed was the high mark. To a pessimist extrapolating oil trends in 2008, of course things looked bad. To a realist who understood that necessity is the mother of all invention, it was far less scary. Assuming that something ugly will stay ugly is an easy forecast to make, and it's persuasive because it doesn't require imagining the world changing. But problems correct and people adapt. Threats incentivize solutions in equal magnitude. That's a common plot of economic history that is too easily forgotten by pessimists who forecast in straight lines. A third is that progress happens too slowly to notice, but setbacks happen too quickly to ignore. There are lots of overnight tragedies. There are rarely overnight miracles. On June 5th, 1889, the Detroit Free Press pushed back against the long-held dream that man could one day fly like a bird. Airplanes, the paper wrote, appear impossible. The smallest possible weight of a flying machine, with the necessary fuel and engineer, could not be less than 300 or 400 pounds. But there is a low limit of weight, certainly not much beyond 50 pounds, beyond which it is impossible for an animal to fly. Nature has reached this limit, and with her utmost effort, has failed to pass it. 6 months later, Orville Wright dropped out of high school to help his brother Wilbur tinker in their backyard shed to build a printing press. It was the brothers' first joint invention. It would not be their last. If you had to make a list of the most important inventions of the 20th century, the airplane would be at least top five, if not number one. The airplane changed everything. It started world wars. It ended world wars. It connected the world, bridging gaps between cities and rural communities, oceans and countries. But the story of the Wright brothers' quest to build the first plane has a fascinating twist. After they conquered flight, no one seemed to notice. Nobody seemed to care. In his 1952 book on American history, Frederick Lewis Allen wrote, "Several years went by before the public grasped what the Wrights were doing. People were so convinced that flying was impossible that most of those who saw them flying about Dayton, Ohio in 1905 decided that what they had seen must be some trick without significance, somewhat as most people today would regard a demonstration of, say, telepathy. It was not until May 1908, nearly 4.5 years after the Wrights' first flight, that experienced reporters were sent to observe what they were doing. Experienced editors gave full credence to these reporters' excited dispatches, and the world at last woke up to the fact that human flight had been successfully accomplished." Even after people caught on to the plane's wonder, they underestimated it for years. First, it was seen mainly as a military weapon, then a rich person's toy, then perhaps used to transport a few people. The Washington Post wrote in 1909, "There will never be such a thing as commercial aerial freighters. Freight will continue to drag its slow weight across the patient earth." The first cargo plane took off 5 months later. Now compare that slow, years-long awakening to becoming optimistic about the airplane to how quickly people pay attention to drivers of pessimism, like a corporate bankruptcy, or a major war, or a plane crash. Some of the first mentions of the Wrights' plane came in 1908 when an Army lieutenant named Thomas Selfridge was killed during a demonstration flight. Growth is driven by compounding, which always takes time. Destruction is driven by single points of failure, which can happen in seconds, and loss of confidence, which can happen in an instant. It's easier to create a narrative around pessimism because the story pieces tend to be fresher and more recent. Optimistic narratives require looking at a long stretch of history and developments, which people tend to forget and take more effort to piece together. Consider the progress of medicine. Looking at the last year will do you little good. Any single decade won't do much better. But looking at the last 50 years will show something extraordinary. For example, the age-adjusted death rate per capita from heart disease has declined more than 70% since 1965, according to the National Institute of Health. A 70% decline in heart disease death is enough to save something like 500,000 American lives per year. Picture the population of Atlanta saved every year. But since that progress happened so slowly, it captures less attention than quick, sudden losses like terrorism, plane crashes, or natural disasters. We could have a Hurricane Katrina 5 times a week, every week. Imagine how much attention that would receive. And it would not offset the number of annual lives saved by the decline in heart disease in the last 50 years. This same thing applies to business, where it takes years to realize how important a product or company is, but failures can happen overnight. And in stock markets, where a 40% decline that takes place in 6 months will draw congressional investigations, but a 140% gain that takes place over 6 years can go virtually unnoticed. And in careers, where reputations take a lifetime to build and a single email to destroy, the short sting of pessimism prevails while the powerful pull of optimism goes unnoticed. This underscores an important point made previously in this book. In investing, you must identify the price of success. Volatility and loss amid the long backdrop of growth, and be willing to pay it. In 2004, the New York Times interviewed Stephen Hawking, the scientist whose incurable motor neuron disease left him paralyzed and unable to talk at age 21. Through his computer, Hawking told the interviewer how excited he was to sell books to lay people. "Are you always this cheerful?" the Times asked. "My expectations were reduced to zero when I was 21. Everything since then has been a bonus," he replied. Expecting things to be great means a best-case scenario that feels flat. Pessimism reduces expectations, narrowing the gap between possible outcomes and outcomes you feel great about. Maybe that's why it's so seductive. Expecting things to be bad is the best way to be pleasantly surprised when they're not, which, ironically, is something to be optimistic about. Now, a short story about stories. Chapter 18, When You'll Believe Anything. Imagine an alien dispatched to Earth. His job is to keep tabs on our economy. He circles above New York City, trying to size up the economy and how it changed between 2007 and 2009. On New Year's Eve 2007, he hovers over Times Square. He sees tens of thousands of happy partygoers surrounded by bright lights, monstrous billboards, fireworks, and TV cameras. He comes back to Times Square on New Year's Eve 2009. He sees tens of thousands of happy partygoers surrounded by bright lights, monstrous billboards, fireworks, and TV cameras. It looks about the same. He cannot see much difference. He sees roughly the same number of New Yorkers hustling around the city. Those people are surrounded by the same number of office buildings, which house the same number of desks, with the same number of computers hooked up to the same number of internet connections. Outside the city, he sees the same number of factories and warehouses, connected by the same highways, carrying the same number of trucks. He gets a little closer to the ground and sees the same universities teaching the same topics and handing out the same degrees to the same number of people. He sees the same number of patents protecting the same groundbreaking ideas. He notices the technology has improved. Everyone in 2009 carries smartphones that didn't exist in 2007. Computers are now faster, medicine is better, cars get better gas mileage, solar and fracking technology has advanced, social media has grown exponentially. As he flies around the country, he sees the same. Around the globe, more of the same. The economy is in about the same shape, maybe even better in 2009 as it was in 2007, he concludes. Then he looks at the numbers. He's shocked that U.S. households are $16 trillion poorer in 2009 than they were in 2007. He's dumbfounded that 10 million more Americans are unemployed. He's in disbelief when he learns the stock market is worth half of what it was 2 years before. He can't believe that people's forecast of their economic potential has plunged. "I don't get it," he says. "I've seen the cities. I've looked at the factories. You guys have the same knowledge, the same tools, the same ideas. Nothing has changed. Why are you poorer? Why are you more pessimistic?" There was one change the alien couldn't see between 2007 and 2009. The stories we told ourselves about the economy. In 2007, we told a story about the stability of housing prices, the prudence of bankers, and the ability of financial markets to accurately price risk. In 2009, we stopped believing that story. That's the only thing that changed, but it made all the difference in the world. Once the narrative that home prices will keep rising broke, mortgage defaults rose, then banks lost money, then they reduced lending to other businesses, which led to layoffs, which led to less spending, which led to more layoffs, and on and on. Other than clinging to a new narrative, we had an identical, if not greater, capacity for wealth and growth in 2009 as we did in 2007. Yet the economy suffered its worst hit in 80 years. This is different from, say, Germany in 1945, whose manufacturing base had been obliterated, or Japan in the 2000s, whose working-age population was shrinking. That's tangible economic damage. In 2009, we inflicted narrative damage on ourselves, and it was vicious. It's one of the most potent economic forces that exists. When we think about the growth of economies, businesses, investments, and careers, we tend to think about tangible things. How much stuff do we have, and what are we capable of? But stories are, by far, the most powerful force in the economy. They are the fuel that can let the tangible parts of the economy work, or the brake that holds our capabilities back. At the personal level, there are two things to keep in mind about a story-driven world when managing your money. One, the more you want something to be true, the more likely you are to believe a story that overestimates the odds of it being true. What was the happiest day of your life? The documentary How to Live Forever asks that innocent question to a centenarian who offered an amazing response. Armistice Day, she said, referring to the 1918 agreement that ended World War I. Why? The producer asks. Because we knew there would be no more wars ever again, she says. World War II began 21 years later, killing 75 million people. There are many things in life that we think are true because we desperately want them to be true. I call these things appealing fictions. They have a big impact on how we think about money, particularly investments and the economy. An appealing fiction happens when you are smart, you want to find solutions, but face a combination of limited control and high stakes. They are extremely powerful. They can make you believe just about anything. Take a short example. Ali Hajjaji's son was sick. Elders in his Yemeni village proposed a folk remedy. Shove the tip of a burning stick through his son's chest to drain the sickness from his body. After the procedure, Hajjaji told the New York Times, "When you have no money and your son is sick, you'll believe anything." Medicine predates useful medicine by thousands of years. Before the scientific method and discovery of germs, there was bloodletting, starvation therapy, cutting holes in your body to let the evils out, and other treatments that did nothing but hasten your demise. It seems crazy, but if you desperately need a solution and a good one isn't known or readily available to you, the path of least resistance is toward Hajjaji's reasoning, willing to believe anything. Not just try anything, but believe it. Chronicling the Great Plague of London, Daniel Defoe wrote in 1722, "The people were more addicted to prophecies and astrological conjurations, dreams, and old wives' tales than ever they were before or since. Almanacs frightened them terribly. The posts of houses and corners of streets were plastered over with doctors' bills and papers of ignorant fellows quacking and inviting the people to come to them for remedies, which was generally set off with such flourishes as these: infallible preventative pills against the plague, never-failing preservatives against the infection, sovereign cordials against the corruption of the air." The plague killed a quarter of Londoners in 18 months. You'll believe just about anything when the stakes are that high. Now think about how the same set of limited information and high stakes impact our financial decisions. Why do people listen to TV investment commentary that has little track record of success? Partly because the stakes are so high in investing. Get a few stock picks right, and you can become rich without much effort. If there's a 1% chance that someone's prediction will come true, and it coming true will change your life, it's not crazy to pay attention, just in case. And there are so many financial opinions that once you pick a strategy or side, you become invested in them both financially and mentally. If you want a certain stock to rise tenfold, that's your tribe. If you think a certain economic policy will spark hyperinflation, that's your side. These may be low probability bets. The problem is that viewers can't or don't calibrate low odds like a 1% chance. Many default to a firm belief that what they want to be true is unequivocally true. But they're only doing that because the possibility of a huge outcome exists. Investing is one of the only fields that offers daily opportunities for extreme rewards. People believe in financial quackery in a way they never would for, say, weather quackery, because the rewards for correctly predicting what the stock market will do next week are in a different universe than the rewards for predicting whether it will be sunny or rainy next week. Consider that 85% of active mutual funds underperformed their benchmark over the 10 years ending 2018. That figure has been fairly stable for generations. You would think an industry with such poor performance would be a niche service and have a hard time staying in business. But there's almost $5 trillion invested in these funds. Give someone the chance of investing alongside the next Warren Buffett, and they'll believe with such faith that millions of people will put their life savings behind it. Or take Bernie Madoff. In hindsight, his Ponzi scheme should have been obvious. He reported returns that never varied. They were audited by a relatively unknown accounting firm, and he refused to release much information on how the returns were achieved. Yet Madoff raised billions of dollars from some of the most sophisticated investors in the world. He told a good story, and people wanted to believe it. This is a big part of why room for error, flexibility, and financial independence, important themes discussed in previous chapters, are indispensable. The bigger the gap between what you want to be true and what you need to be true to have an acceptable outcome, the more you are protecting yourself from falling victim to an appealing financial fiction. When thinking about room for error in a forecast, it is tempting to think that potential outcomes range from you being just right enough to you being very, very right. But the biggest risk is that you want something to be true so badly that the range of your forecast isn't even in the same ballpark as reality. In its last 2007 meeting, the Federal Reserve predicted what economic growth would be in 2008 and 2009. Already weary of a weakening economy, it was not optimistic. It predicted a range of potential growth, 1.6% growth on the low end, 2.8% on the high end. That was its margin of safety. It's room for error. In reality, the economy contracted by more than 2%, meaning the Fed's low-end estimate was off by almost threefold. It's hard for a policymaker to predict an outright recession, because a recession will make their careers complicated. So even worst-case projections rarely expect anything worse than just slowish growth. It's an appealing fiction. And it's easy to believe because expecting anything worse is too painful to consider. Policymakers are easy targets for criticism, but all of us do this to some extent. And we do it in both directions. If you think a recession is coming and you cash out of your stocks in anticipation, your view of the economy is suddenly going to be warped by what you want to happen. Every blip, every anecdote will look like a sign that doom has arrived. Maybe not because it has, but because you want it to. Incentives are a powerful motivator, and we should always remember how they influence our own financial goals and outlooks. It can't be overstated. There is no greater force in finance than room for error, and the higher the stakes, the wider it should be. 2. Everyone has an incomplete view of the world, but we form a complete narrative to fill in the gaps. My daughter is about a year old as I write this. She's curious about everything and learns so fast. But sometimes I think about all the stuff she can't comprehend. She has no idea why her dad goes to work every morning, the concept of bills, budgets, careers, promotions, and saving for retirement are completely foreign to her. Imagine trying to explain the Federal Reserve, credit derivatives, or NAFTA to her. Impossible. But her world isn't dark. She does not wander around in confusion. Even at a year old, she's written her own internal narrative of how everything works. Blankets keep you warm, mom's snuggles keep you safe, and dates taste good. Everything she comes across fits into one of a few dozen mental models she's learned. When I go to work, she doesn't stop in confusion, wondering what salary and bills are. She has a crystal clear explanation of the situation. Dad isn't playing with me, and I wanted him to play with me, so I'm sad. Even though she knows little, she doesn't realize it because she tells herself a coherent story about what's going on based on the little she does know. All of us, no matter our age, do the same thing. Just like my daughter, I don't know what I don't know, so I am just as susceptible to explaining the world through the limited set of mental models I have at my disposal. Like her, I look for the most understandable cases in everything I come across. And like her, I'm wrong about a lot of them because I know a lot less about how the world works than I think I do. This is true for the most fact-based of subjects. Take history. It's just the recounting of stuff that already happened. It should be clear and objective. But as B.H. Liddell Hart writes in his book, Why Don't We Learn from History? History cannot be interpreted without the aid of imagination and intuition. The sheer quantity of evidence is so overwhelming that selection is inevitable. Where there is selection, there is art. Those who read history tend to look for what proves them right and confirms their personal opinions. They defend loyalties. They read with a purpose to affirm or to attack. They resist inconvenient truth, since everyone wants to be on the side of the angels, just as we start wars to end all wars. Daniel Kahneman once told me about the stories people tell themselves to make sense of the past. He said, "Hindsight, the ability to explain the past, gives us the illusion that the world is understandable. It gives us the illusion that the world makes sense even when it doesn't make sense. That's a big deal in producing mistakes in many fields." Most people, when confronted with something they don't understand, do not realize they don't understand it because they're able to come up with an explanation that makes sense based on their own unique perspective and experiences in the world, however limited those experiences are. We all want the complicated world we live in to make sense, so we tell ourselves stories to fill in the gaps of what are effectively blind spots. What these stories do to us financially can be both fascinating and terrifying. When I'm blind to parts of how the world works, I might completely misunderstand why the stock market is behaving like it is, in a way that gives me too much confidence in my ability to know what it might do next. Part of the reason forecasting the stock market and the economy is so hard is because you are the only person in the world who thinks the world operates the way you do. When you make decisions for reasons that I can't even comprehend, I might follow you blindly into a decision that's right for you and disastrous to me. This, as we saw in Chapter 16, is how bubbles form. Coming to terms with how much you don't know means coming to terms with how much of what happens in the world is out of your control. And that can be hard to accept. Think about market forecasts. We're very, very bad at them. I once calculated that if you assume that the market goes up every year by its historic average, your accuracy is better than if you follow the average annual forecasts of the top 20 market strategists from large Wall Street banks. Our ability to predict recessions isn't much better. And since big events come out of nowhere, forecasts may do more harm than good, giving the illusion of predictability in a world where unforeseen events control most outcomes. Carl Richards writes, "Risk is what's left over when you think you've thought of everything." People know this. I have not met an investor who genuinely thinks market forecasts as a whole are accurate or useful. But there's still tremendous demand for forecasts in both the media and from financial advisors. Why? Psychologist Philip Tetlock once wrote, "We need to believe we live in a predictable, controllable world. So we turn to authoritative-sounding people who promise to satisfy that need." Satisfying that need is a great way to put it. Wanting to believe we are in control is an emotional itch that needs to be scratched, rather than an analytical problem to be calculated and solved. The illusion of control is more persuasive than the reality of uncertainty. So we cling to stories about outcomes being in our control. Part of this has to do with confusing fields of precision with fields of uncertainty. NASA's New Horizons spacecraft passed by Pluto 2 years ago. It was a 3 billion-mile trip that took 9.5 years. According to NASA, the trip took about 1 minute less than predicted when the craft was launched in January 2006. Think about that. In an untested, decade-long journey, NASA's forecast was 99.99998% accurate. That's like forecasting a trip from New York to Boston and being accurate to within 4 millionths of a second. But astrophysics is a field of precision. It isn't impacted by the vagaries of human behavior and emotions like finance is. Business, economics, and investing are fields of uncertainty, overwhelmingly driven by decisions that can't easily be explained with clean formulas like a trip to Pluto can. But we desperately want it to be like a trip to Pluto, because the idea of a NASA engineer being in 99.99998% control of an outcome is beautiful and comforting. It's so comforting that we're tempted to tell ourselves a story about how much control we have in other parts of our life, like money. Kahneman once laid out the path these stories take. When planning, we focus on what we want to do and can do, neglecting the plans and skills of others whose decisions might affect our outcomes. Both in explaining the past and in predicting the future, we focus on the casual role of skill and neglect the role of luck. We focus on what we know and neglect what we do not know, which makes us overly confident in our beliefs. He described how this impacts businesses. I have had several occasions to ask founders and participants in innovative startups a question. To what extent will the outcome of your effort depend on what you do in your firm? This is evidently an easy question. The answer comes quickly, and it has never been less than 80%. Even when they are not sure they will succeed, these bold people think their fate is almost entirely in their own hands. They are surely wrong. The outcome of a startup depends as much on the achievements of its competitors and on changes in the market as on its own efforts. However, entrepreneurs naturally focus on what they know best, their plans and actions, and the most immediate threats and opportunities, such as the availability of funding. They know less about their competitors and therefore find it natural to imagine a future in which competition plays little part. We all do this to some extent, and like my daughter, it doesn't bother us a bit. We don't wander around blind and confused. We have to think the world we operate in makes sense based on what we happen to know. It'd be too hard to get out of bed in the morning if you felt otherwise. But the alien circling over Earth, the one who's confident he knows what's happening based on what he sees, but turns out to be completely wrong because he can't know the stories going on inside everyone else's head, he's all of us. Chapter 19. All Together Now. Congratulations, you're still listening. It's time to tie together a few things we've learned. This chapter is a bit of a summary, a few short and actionable lessons that can help you make better financial decisions. First, let me tell you a story about a dentist appointment gone horribly awry. It teaches us something vital about the dangers of giving advice about what to do with your money. Clarence Hughes went to the dentist in 1931. His mouth was radiating pain. His dentist put him under crude anesthesia to ease the pain. When Clarence awoke hours later, he had 16 fewer teeth and his tonsils removed. And then everything went wrong. Clarence died a week later from his surgery's complications. His wife sued the dentist, but not because the surgery went awry. Every surgery risked death in 1931. Clarence, she said, never consented to the procedures in the first place, and wouldn't